Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1989, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is an environmentalist. Since the 1970s, he's been telling us that the world is threatened by the carelessness of man, a message which, until recently, seemed to fall on rather deaf ears. Today, however, he finds himself at the centre of an increasingly popular movement. The old Etonian, who learned to love the world while he was a schoolteacher in London, has become, at 38, one of the leaders of Britain's influential green lobby. He is the director of Friends of the Earth, Jonathan Porritt. And he does not have a beard, wear sandals, or eat lentils, Jonathan. Are you forever exasperated by the image?
I am a bit. It doesn't happen quite so much as it used to do. And I think, to be honest, most people now accept that environmentalists are normal human beings who have a range of human attributes that are not particularly eccentric. And I'm happy to say that those bad old days where it was so easy to stereotype us as weird and wacky have really passed away.
And you don't even have to live in the country, do you?
No, indeed not. You don't have to live in the country. And there are a lot of good urban ecologists. It's not quite so easy to be a green living in London or a city as it is living in the country. But it's still important that people do see themselves as environmentalists, even if they live in cities.
But you don't even have a garden, do you?
No, just a balcony where we grow a few flowers and herbs and more or less a sort of rendering of the natural world in a small way, but look forward to the possibility of gardens eventually.
But you don't, as I understand it, even have green fingers.
No, this is true. I'm ashamed about this, really, but I'm pretty well deaf to any plants or flowers that I'm left in charge of, and it's been a source of embarrassment for some time.
So will Britain's best-known green fade away on our desert island because he can't grow anything to eat?
The likelihood is that I'd be in dire trouble very quickly, because although I'm quite good at suggesting that other people should be more self-reliant and get stuck into the world of practical ecology, it just so happens that I'm not very well oriented to it myself, and changing a plug is about the limit of my technological expertise.
Well, there are no plugs, there's just a wind-up gramophone. Is,
yes.
Is the music you'll be able to play on it going to be of any help at all?
Oh yes, it would be. There's no doubt about that. Although I must say that music is not a crucially important part of my life, but it's a very important part of the background to my life, actually, and it plays an important role in terms of helping me to work and creating mood so that I can get on and do things or change my mood or forget the hassles of the day or whatever it might be.
What's the first piece you'd like?
The first piece is the opening of Dvořák's symphony. I've picked this really because it's the first piece of music that I came to terms with when I was very young, had just gone to school, didn't really know much about music, and there was a wonderful man there whose sole intent in life was actually to encourage young people to think about music and to get involved in it. And really, the New World Symphony at that stage was the first thing I'd ever heard, and it was very inspiring.
The opening of Dvořák's Symphony No. 9, the New World Symphony, played by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir George Scholte. When, Jonathan, did you first fall in love with the earth? How far back does it go?
It goes quite a long way back, really. I was very lucky when I was growing up, because we lived near Hampstead Heath, and my parents basically allowed us three children immense freedom to sort of roam over Hampstead Heath. And I think even then, although it didn't sort of look like it in those days, but even then I was immensely attracted by the business of being close to the earth, as it were, and just being out and having the usual kind of adventures that kids have at that age.
But it just seems an odd background, really, born in Hampstead and then Eton and Oxford. It doesn't sound like the likely background for a man of the earth.
No, it doesn't really, does it? I'm not quite sure how it all came together, but I think that I've always believed that each of us has a potential relationship with the earth that is latent in every single person, whether we live in cities or whether we have one educational background or another. And that a lot of the time, our sort of industrial society stamps on that relationship. It turns us into technologically minded people rather than earth minded people. And sometimes I think you can escape that. And I guess that I see it as being lucky. Not everybody would, but I see it as being lucky in that I was able to think much more intimately and affectionately about the earth from a very early age.
And you came very, very close to it, didn't you, in your teens when you went to New Zealand?
Yes, that was particularly special and really lucky that my father went out to New Zealand as Governor General, and we lot spent quite a lot of time over there. And for different reasons, partly because I suppose I was going through the usual adolescent time then, and wasn't necessarily enjoying life completely, my mother thought the best thing to do would be to pack me off and get me planting trees, you know, get rid of all that excess energy. I was about 18 at the time. And that's what I did, actually, for 3 years in a row in the middle of the New Zealand winter. Planted trees on this bit of scrubland in the north of the North Island. And it is, to me, the closest that I've ever got to interpreting that relationship with the earth in a completely non-intellectual way. i.e. just an ordinary living relationship, which is very hard to do when you're sunk in the middle of London and surrounded by concrete and tarmac and vehicle exhausts and all the rest of the wretched delights of so-called civilization.
Shall we have another record?
Yes, the next record I've chosen really is very much to do with my father, who is an amazing man and has been a tremendous source of strength to me in life. I mean, I learnt from a very early age that it was okay to be idealistic and occasionally unworldly, and to pursue dreams even if they seem to be taking you in odd directions. And I learned that really from my father. And one of the things that he did when he was young, was to take up athletics, and he was a very successful athlete and won a bronze medal in the 1924 Olympic Games. And so when the film Chariots of Fire was made, he sort of features in that, not under his own name, because he was approached by the filmmakers at the time, and he was so sort of modest at that stage that he didn't really want his name to appear in the film, which I think is a very touching indication of the way my father works. And that's why I've chosen the theme music from this film.
Theme music from Chariots of Fire, composed and performed by Vangelis. Let's just go back to your school days, to Eton, for a moment, where you were, by all accounts, a great success. What kind of boy were you? Can you describe yourself then?
Remarkably uncomplicated. Just life seemed to be incredibly easy. I enjoyed working, and I was very involved in sports of every description, and every minute of the day seemed to be full. And it's actually almost impossible now to imagine that life was just an uncomplicated flow of enjoyable experiences, which is what it was.
Did you have any idea then of what you wanted to do with your life? Your father was a surgeon, wasn't he? I mean, did you think you'd go into medicine?
No, I knew even then that I wouldn't go into medicine. I used to detest the smell of hospitals. And one of the regular duties that we had to do as dutiful children was to drag round St Mary's at Christmas time while Dad carved this great groaning turkey. And we used to disappear into the bowels of St Mary's, which is a pretty amazing exploration, I can tell you. But the smell of hospitals appalled me. And I think even then that I decided that medicine was not for me. And actually, I was so unthinking about the world in those days that I didn't have a clue what I was going to do, not a single idea. And so drifted through in terms of career development in a very unfocused way, and ended up doing modern languages, not for any particular burning desire to be a linguist, but just because I seemed to be relatively good at them and that was okay and it wasn't very difficult, and so that was what I ended up doing.
But it's all very establishment stuff, the background, isn't it? I mean, you had no inkling then that there was something of a radical lurking within.
No, absolutely not, and I think my friends would probably bear that out. Even later on, when I was at Oxford, I was totally uninterested in politics, to be honest.
And you didn't much care for the sort of society that Oxford offered, did you?
No, I suppose that when I went to Oxford, I began to notice much more about the way in which society worked, and in a slightly pious way that can't have been terribly pleasant to have shared with anybody, I began to worry about why people didn't make more of the privileges they seemed to have, and why such appalling social and intellectual snobbery was so much part of an Oxford education. And those things really got to me at that time, probably far more than they should have done, with the result that I became really quite deeply antisocial, and as rapidly as possible actually moved out of the town of Oxford to a small cottage in a village near Oxford, where I had, a very pleasant time by virtue of not having to come into Oxford and doing all my work out there and sort of going for long walks. And those were happy days, but they were also days when I really revelled in solitude. And that's actually why I've picked this next piece of music, because I have a sort of peculiar interest or affection almost for the idea of the monastic life. And one thing that I really miss now in this hectic round of activity with Friends of the Earth is any opportunity for being alone and being more reflective and just slowing down the pace of things and thinking much more about the deeper issues that matter to me. So I hope that this piece of music, the Nunc Dimittis, sung by the choir of the Carmelite Priory, will actually remind me of that more reflective side of life.
Nunc Dimittis, sung by the choir of the Carmelite Priory, London, directed by John McCarthy. Well, you didn't go into the church, Jonathan. You drifted into the law after graduating. There's a lovely story that you were on your way to court, I think, one day, and you decided to go to the zoo instead, and at that point you decided the law was not for you. Is there any truth in this story?
It's almost true. I wasn't on my way to court, but I was on my way to the college where I was studying law. And I'd been there for 3 months, and I had confronted the reality that I was not going to be a lawyer. I really felt very bad about failing at something. There was a sort of strong need to do well in everything that I did. And this was the first time that something had gone seriously wrong, and I found it quite uncomfortable. So I used to resort to the zoo, and I used to look at the antics of the monkeys and all the rest of it and think to myself, well, it can't be that bad. And when I was wandering around the zoo, bunking off my law course, I eventually decided, let's face it, I'm not going to be a lawyer. Let's do what I really want to do, which is to be a teacher. And in those days, there was such a shortage of teachers that I was able to get a job immediately, that literally the day after I'd sort of decided that this wasn't going to work in the law, because there was a school in the East End, in Newham, which was short of 3 teachers, I think, in its English department. And so they would have taken anybody, frankly. And the fact that I didn't have a degree in English, and the fact that I'd never taught English, and the fact that I'd never been in a school of that kind before, didn't make any difference at all. I was a body, and I was a body that could be stood in a classroom, and I was tall, which was an advantage, because if they threw things at me, I was likely to come back perhaps a little bit more strongly than others might have done.
Well, you went on teaching, didn't you, until, what, about 4 years ago?
Yes, until 1984.
Do you miss it now?
I still do, actually. Yes, I still miss contact with children. Just that sense of joy in watching children grow up and learn things and suddenly discover things that weren't in them before. I'm involved in teaching in a different kind of way now, and sometimes my audiences are almost as badly behaved as they were in Shepherd's Bush, in a different way. But I've often thought about whether or not I'll go back into teaching.
Well, now, it was, I understand, when you were head of drama and English at a school in Shepherd's Bush that you found yourself ever more concerned about the future of the earth and the danger of our doing nothing about it. How did that come about?
The English department wanted to do something to try and lift up the eyes of those children above the concrete jungle of Shepherd's Bush and to start thinking about an environment beyond that incredibly closed and often very violent and unpleasant environment. And so we used to do various things like take classes down to Wales where we'd stay in youth hostels, and that was tremendous. And we also did quite a few projects about trying to envisage the future. What would the world look like in the year 2000? And that made me read an awful lot about what other people thought the world was going to be like in the year 2000. And that was pretty gloomy reading, I must say. And the more I read, the more it kind of seized my mind that we were living in a lunatic and irresponsible way.
Were you already feeling political about it? Had you already joined the Ecology Party?
No, I joined the Ecology Party in 1975. And I'm not quite sure why I ended up immediately joining the Ecology Party, which is now called the Green Party, of course, because I could have joined a whole range of different organisations. But I was rather struck with the idea of a tiny band of people, which is what it then was, I mean, really tiny, trying to put across a totally different vision of life. And I was really taken by the almost insane political courage involved in this, because at that time there was no real backing for it at all amongst people. And I can well remember some of the, I'm sure, very well-meaning jokes and taunts of some of my friends, which indicated that, as far as they were concerned, I was definitely moving onto the fringes very rapidly.
Well, also, I mean, you met time and again with enormous political indifference. I mean, you're the veteran of many an election campaign, general elections, European elections, local elections. It does take, is it courage to meet time and again with that kind of indifference?
Persistence, definitely, and readiness to accept that you are not necessarily going to be successful in conventional terms, i.e. number of votes you gather.
Shall we pause for some more music?
It's the next piece I've chosen was something that I used to listen to a lot around this time when I was at school. I love guitar music, and I was a particular fan, I suppose, of Santana, and this is a piece of theirs called Samba Party.
Santana and Samba Party. How surprised were you, Jonathan Porritt, when towards the end of last year the Prime Minister told the Royal Society that to have a cavalier attitude towards our planet was a dangerous thing?
I was genuinely taken aback, I must admit, because, to be honest, there hadn't been any indication that Mrs. Thatcher was going to get involved in the environment up until then. In fact, on one occasion she described the environment as humdrum and boring, and so we didn't know that this great this political volte-face was going to take place.
And how has it changed your professional life?
A lot. It really has made quite a difference. I'm not sure whether she meant it this way, but of course what it has done is to give a level of credibility to the concerns of environmentalists that simply wasn't there before. And for various reasons, no politician, certainly not the opposition parties, had actually taken up environmental matters with any kind of campaigning fervour up until that point. Yes, I mean, they'd come out with some of the right noises about the environment and sounded fairly good on this policy and were always there to be heard when there was a disaster or something had gone wrong. But they hadn't actually seen the environment as being a priority that they would put in the same ranking as those other normal concerns that politicians have. So when Mrs. Thatcher, quotes, went green, quotes, it changed the entire climate of opinion about environmental matters.
But you are sometimes heard to be quite sceptical about Mrs. Thatcher's greenness and to call her various names. I think you've called her an elastoplast environmentalist. I mean, should you be doing that? Why don't you just seize it with both hands and welcome it?
I think we do both, which may be confusing. We do welcome it with open hands, to be quite honest, because it is infinitely better to have world leaders of the stature of Mrs. Thatcher out there saying the environment counts, indeed saying it is the greatest challenge we face between now and the end of the century, than to have her out there disregarding the environment altogether. I think scepticism, however, is still justified on the basis of the track record, and that we're still really waiting for a change of policy to match the change of heart. And you can only really judge someone in politics on the actions, not the words. The words come cheap. They're easy, basically. Green rhetoric is everybody's game these days. Green action is altogether another story.
Of course, if you personally decided to stand as a candidate for an established party, you could perhaps achieve much of that which you seek to achieve.
I would find it enormously difficult, quite honestly, to join one of the major parties, because I do have really profound differences on critical issues like whether economic growth is the answer to all our prayers, whether our industrial society has the kind of values that are actually going to make life bearable or decent for people in the future, on the whole question of the distribution of wealth to the third world. And these are such burning concerns for me that it isn't just a question about the environmental differences between us. It is a question about the whole structure of society and the world economic order. And so if I did join up with a major party instead of the Green Party, I think I would very quickly feel ill at ease, and I'm not sure that I'd be very happy about that.
Your fifth record, please.
This is a rather special record for me. It's a hymn, Hills of the North Rejoice, and I suppose that I will be sitting there on my desert island thinking about all the things that I'll be missing back home, and one of the things that I will be missing is good, kind of gutsy renderings of good hymns. I love this hymn in particular because it also reminds me of the oneness of life on earth, north, south, east and west, and the fact that God's earth is something that we should all be working to protect.
Hills of the North Rejoice by the Canterbury Cathedral Choir. Jonathan, the stories of man and the damage that he is doing to the environment are now in the news every day, it seems, and some of them apocalyptic in their vision, London disappearing beneath water and the climate changing beyond recognition. I mean, is, in your view, the engine of destruction irreversible?
It's a very powerful engine, and there's no point underestimating its capacity for destruction, because it's wrapped everybody up in this great onward march towards what we call progress, which actually entails destroying all our life support systems in the process. So it is a powerful thing, there's no doubt about it, but I don't think it's irreversible. And what, obviously, we've all been engaged in doing is to slow down the engine and eventually to get a different vision of progress so that people stop bashing the earth in the process of trying to get richer. And I think what is happening now is actually much more hopeful than anything that's happened before, partly because more and more individuals are saying, well, hang on a minute, I can actually make a difference here. It may be small, it may be a tiny little thing in comparison to the size of the problem. If you're talking about the loss of the ozone layer, for instance, through CFCs and other ozone-depleting chemicals, it may not seem much that one individual should say, right, I'm not going to buy this aerosol because it contains CFCs. But actually, when enough individuals say, I'm not going to buy this aerosol, that makes for a very powerful shift in society. And I think that it's fair to point out that actually going green in this fairly light green way is not enough, but it is a start. And I have a very strong belief that one ought to encourage people wherever they are, rather than kind of berate them for not being a darker hue of green, to actually encourage them step by step to see that there is more that they can do And the first step they've taken is only a first step towards a very different, sustainable society.
But what would a real dark green, as you call it, want us to do tomorrow?
So a dark green would really pitch the challenge much more profoundly at the unsustainability of our existing industrial culture.
And are you, as director of Friends of the Earth, not that dark green?
Friends of the Earth exists to improve a system which we are landed with here and now. But I think a lot of us in it have darker green visions of where we should be going.
But you prefer outwardly to be an optimistic, lighter green?
Although we have to be careful about this, it is right, actually, to push more positive messages at people and to give them a sense of empowerment so that they feel they can do something. And also, I think it's important to start celebrating the Earth. Instead of being sheepish about this, actually to say, look, we have got this incredible miracle here to enjoy, and that if we learn to attune ourselves more finely and sensitively to the Earth, it is a source of untold joy for people. And it doesn't cost you anything. It's there. It comes for free if we learn how to appreciate it properly. That's really why I've chosen for my next piece, which I'm glad that you allowed me, some of the music from the, if you can call it music, from the humpback whale. And I've been a great devotee of whale music for many years and love these recordings. And it did also just occur to me that maybe as I'm sitting there worrying about whether I'm going to be able to grow my food on this island, that I may be able to commune with the whales by playing this record extremely loud, so they'll come and give me some sort of encouragement in my solitude.
Humpback whale music or noises. You might get it for free, of course, Jonathan. You never know.
You never know. They might seek me out.
Would it be fair to say that your commitment to the environment is as much emotional as intellectual?
I think so, yes. I think that it's based on what I would describe as intellectual or scientific, really. And that's come about because of the need to get things right, to be sure that your information is correct, and to know that you're not selling people a bum message because you're simply not using the factual information properly. So that's been very important, and that's the foundation on which a lot is built. But it's fair to say that underneath that, for me, there is an immensely powerful emotional theme running through a lot of what I do. And I doubt, frankly, that I would be that involved in this somewhat over-frenetic way if it wasn't a powerful emotional thing.
Is it spiritual too?
Yes, it is for me. I genuinely do feel that there's a sort of responsibility for each of us to do our bit, to work within God's earth rather than actually to destroy it. And I'm also a bit of a pagan, that I don't find much difficulty relating to the living earth quite directly. It would be a bit of an exaggeration to say that I go around talking to flowers or hugging trees all the time, but I feel no difficulty whatsoever in communing pretty effortlessly with nature. And also, when I am tired and depressed and I begin to think about the unbelievable folly and irresponsibility of humankind, the easiest way of getting myself through that, quite honestly, is to just re-engage with the earth, because you seem to get a different set of messages then.
Of course, the public interest comes in spasms, doesn't it? I mean, when whales are trapped underneath the ice, or when there's a disaster at a Russian nuclear power station, we're all desperately interested for a couple of weeks, and then it all fades away again.
It doesn't all fade away again. And I think that the interesting thing is to see whether or not the general level of concern and awareness is increased by a tiny little bit once that spasm of concern has faded away, because it does fade away. At that level, it fades away very quickly. But the fascinating thing for us is actually to see whether or not you've got a gradual increase, inching up, so that every time you get another reminder about the fragility of our life support systems or the, you know, the extent to which we're mucking it all up, that reminder then adds to the general awareness that is gradually growing. And I think that's what's happening now. And it's true to say that people have probably forgotten most of the lessons specifically of Chernobyl now, and it won't be long before they forget all the problems about the death of the seals in the North Sea. But these things kind of lock away in the back of people's minds, and they're there as little niggles, little worries about whether we're doing it right.
Another record, please.
I've chosen for my next record a favourite, I suppose, of lots of people, which is Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water. And this will remind me in particular of the extent to which I had to give up most of my friends, actually, by being a friend of the Earth, because it is such a hopelessly frenetic life. There doesn't any longer seem to be time for friends in the way that there once was. And that's one of the things that makes me saddest. So this would actually remind me that when I do get back to my ordinary life from the island, that I will put that to rights.
When you're weary, feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I will dry them all. I'm on your side. Oh,
Simon and Garfunkel, Bridge Over Troubled Water. Your term at Friends of the Earth, Jonathan, comes to an end next year. You've said that there are no mainstream politics on the agenda. What can a linguist passionate about our planet do next?
I think I'm going to do more writing, and I hope more sort of speaking and that kind of thing. And I'm actually going to sort of take it a bit easy for a while, because I will have been 6 years at Friends of the Earth when I finish there this time next year. And there will certainly be space for a bit of consideration and reflection on the vast mass of things that have happened over the last 6 years. But I imagine, one way or another, I shall be just as actively involved as I am now.
But you are, as we've heard, what you might call an urban green. Is there part of you that would actually like to be living halfway up a mountainside in Wales?
Yes, there is, actually, very much so. And I think it's quite likely that we'll move out of London. I'm not a natural country liver, it has to be said. I don't sort of feel a great yearning to be in the countryside the whole time, and I don't feel that I can only be green if I'm out there in the midst of those green fields. But equally, bringing up children and all the rest of it means that the call of the countryside is a bit louder now than it's ever been before.
Yes, children focus the mind somehow. You have a young baby daughter.
Yes, six months, yeah.
Do you think of it in those terms, which I think an awful lot of people do? You know, what kind of planet are we leaving behind for the children? I mean, do you go to bed at night worrying about that future for them?
Well, the funny thing is that having worried about it in abstract terms, it's amazing now to have a sort of living embodiment of the future there in our midst, as it were. And it does make it very much more compelling. It really does bring it home in the most astonishing way. And I've often thought, to be quite honest, that the saving of the planet, and therefore for me the saving of humankind, will come because people start putting their children, their grandchildren, above them. And they'll start realizing that some of the things which we apparently demand now are ruining the chances of the next generation. That's the only thing that is likely to provide a sufficiently powerful motivation to slow down the engine of destruction that we were talking about.
Shall we have your last record?
The last record is some piano music, which I listen to a lot, and I've picked one of my favourite bits of piano music, which is Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 6.
Thank you.
the second movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 6 in B-flat major, played by Vladimir Ashkenazy with the Philharmonia Orchestra. Now, which, Jonathan, of those eight do you hold most dear?
Well, I'm going to pick the whale music, because I think that's actually probably speaks to me more powerfully than all the music put together by human beings.
And a book we can supply you with. You have the Bible and you have the complete Shakespeare.
I'm going to pick a Dickens novel. I've worried about this for a long time, which one, whether it was going to be Bleak House or Little Dorrit, but eventually I have plumped for Bleak House, because I find Dickens totally absorbing and I could disappear into his world whenever my world began to get rather boring.
And a luxury, which must be of no practical use whatsoever.
If I may, I would like to take a fountain pen, which would not be functional because I'd just be writing nice things and reflecting on the meaning of life. And I'm assuming that I'll be able to get ink from a squid and make my own paper from papyrus, which could stretch my ingenuity, I must admit. But I don't think I'd be able to make my own pen, so if I may, I'll take a fountain pen.
Excellent. Jonathan Porritt, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.